Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The Global Story with smart takes and fresh perspectives on one big news story. Every Monday to Friday from the BBC World Service. Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts. To find out more.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Rachel Wright, and at 2 p.m. on Tuesday, the 20th of February, these are our main stories. The US calls for a temporary ceasefire in Gaza at the UN. Countries including South Africa and the Netherlands address the UN's highest court about Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories. The WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange makes another attempt to fight extradition to the US. Also in this podcast, we find out what's happened to Russia's Wagner Group.
It is the use of hard power to try and suppress opposition to the government in countries that are relatively fragile and ethnically diverse.
The United States has proposed a draft resolution at the UN Security Council calling for a temporary ceasefire in Gaza as soon as feasible. The text reflects the language used by President Biden in talks with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, as Neda Taufik explains.
It is certainly a toughening of language, this phrase, a temporary ceasefire as soon as practicable. I mean, that really echoes the language that President Joe Biden has used in his conversations with Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu last week. We heard, you know, President Biden saying that he really does want to see a temporary ceasefire. It's what the United States is working towards in negotiations with Qatar, Egypt, Israel. So certainly it's along the U.S.'s position, but if you look at the rest of this proposed resolution, the United States is certainly trying to register its opposition to Israel's plans to go into Rafah. For example, the text condemns calls by some Israeli government ministers for Jewish settlers to move to Gaza or any attempt at demographic or territorial change there. And it really sounds the alarm in terms of saying that this would be a real threat to peace and security. The United States is not abandoning in any way its ally Israel, but it is using the forum, the UN Security Council, to, as I say, register its opposition to Israel's plans.
Our correspondent in Jerusalem is Jenny Hill. I asked her if there would be a sense in Israel of being abandoned by the US.
I think at a government level, this won't come as a great deal of a surprise because we've heard Joe Biden's administration sort of toughening its language towards its ally in recent days and weeks. Benjamin Netanyahu, for his part, has remained completely defiant in the face of growing, well, international pressure, not just from the US, about the human cost of his military operation in Gaza, launched, of course, in response to the October the 7th attacks. So from his perspective, I expect we'll see more insistence on continuing with his plan. And he, of course, justifies the ground invasion, the planned ground invasion of Rafah, on the basis that he says there are still battalions of Hamas fighters holed up in the city. He also says, you know, Israel wants its hostages back. And he has repeatedly said that the only way really to get them back is to continue with military pressure. So I'm not sure that there will be any sense of abandonment at that point. Certainly no surprise. From the public perspective, I think there is growing concern here about the government's handling of all of this. Just yesterday in Jerusalem, there was a group of women protesting outside the Prime Minister's official residence. They're concerned about getting those hostages back. The families of hostages are really worried about the strategies being employed at the moment. And I think some of them would very much more favour a more diplomatic approach, a more negotiations-based approach. They're, of course, desperately worried about the physical safety of those hostages, you know, who are being held in Gaza, where airstrikes and all sorts of ground operations are being carried out. So perhaps there's going to be more consternation on the ground in Israel than at government level.
I believe that there has been some footage of the October the 7th attack that been put out overnight.
Yeah, interestingly, I mean, the day after Israel said it would give Hamas 3 weeks to release all of its hostages or that ground offensive will begin in Rafah, we now have some footage from the Israeli Defence Forces who say they recently discovered footage from a security camera inside Gaza. It purports to show, and you can see this online, it shows apparently the Bibas family, a mother and two of her children, one of whom's only a baby, apparently being kidnapped on October the 7th, driven away, pushed into a car and driven away. Now, the family's fate is unclear. Hamas said that the entire family was killed in an Israeli airstrike, but Israel said it's still looking into what's actually happened to them. So we don't know what's happened to them. We don't really know for certain whether they are still alive or not. But it, of course, has reminded, as if Israelis needed reminding, the plight of those hostages. And I suppose it backs up what the Israeli Prime Minister is saying. You know, Israel wants its hostages back and it's going to continue to fight until it gets them.
Jenny Hill in Jerusalem. The UN's International Court of Justice in The Hague is holding a public hearing on whether Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories since the Six-Day War in 1967 is legal. The court session started on Monday. Today was the turn of the legal team from South Africa to put their case.
The United Nations, especially the Security Council and General Assembly, must use all measures within their powers to bring an immediate end to the unlawful Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem. The United Nations should also continuously monitor implementation of any order that the court may give to end the racial discrimination and apartheid by Israel in the occupied Palestinian territory.
Our correspondent in The Hague is Anna Holligan. I put it to her that South Africa using the word apartheid in relation to Israel was very strong language.
And of course it resonates. You heard there from South Africa's lawyer. We also heard from South Africa's ambassador to the Netherlands, even stronger language. He accused Israel of applying a more extreme version of apartheid in the Palestinian territories than experienced in South Africa before 1994. Vusi Muzi Mandisela told the court, we as South Africans sense, see, hear and feel to our core the inhumane discriminatory policies and practices of the Israeli regime as an even more extreme form of the apartheid that was institutionalized against black people in my country. So he called on all settlements to be dismantled and the two-state solution implemented. And of course, those allegations have been rejected by Israel, which has argued the occupation is a temporary and necessary security measure.
But we won't hear from Israel in the court, is that right?
That's right. So Israel doesn't recognise the ICJ's jurisdiction over its occupation of the West Bank, but actually submitted a 5-page document in which it said this whole case could be detrimental to solving the conflict because the questions posed by the UN General Assembly, so that's how we arrived here at this case, it was a case brought by the UN General Assembly in December 2022, were prejudiced. And I just want to tell you very briefly, Rachel, I've stepped outside the court and I can see for the first time since these hearings began two groups of protesters standing not very far apart, one waving Palestinian flags, the other Israeli flags. You might be able to hear the rumble of cars in the background too. We're just approaching the lunch break here. A record number of countries are taking part in this, 51 in total. So we heard from South Africa, we also heard from Saudi Arabia, just looking back at my notes here. Saudi Arabia also called for an end to what he described as the brutality. He said it could not be used as an excuse for defeating Hamas. He also said the acquisition of territory by the use of force was a violation of international law. So we will be hearing from 51 countries in total. The Netherlands is speaking now. And then it will take the judges probably about 6 months to reach their advisory opinion, which is not legally binding, but will carry huge political weight.
Anna Holligan in The Hague. More than a million Palestinians who've had to flee their homes are now living in conditions of severe hardship in the south of the Gaza Strip. But some Israelis have also felt the need to move, both from areas near Gaza and from the north of Israel, where Israeli troops and Hezbollah forces in Lebanon have been exchanging rocket fire. Now, some of these Israelis have been returning, as our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson reports.
Above the spacious veranda they use as a living room, Ayelet and Shahar have hung a vast black flag. a show of solidarity with the hostages held in Gaza, 19 of them taken from here in Kfar Azar. Ayelet and Shahar are the first to return here full-time. More than 60 people were killed here when Hamas gunmen overran the kibbutz. Faith in Israel's ability to protect left in tatters.
We bought into the con. They con us. Maybe they convinced themselves that what they're saying is the truth, but obviously it wasn't. A lot will have to change.
Since the October attacks, 200,000 people have been displaced from Israel's borders. Some of them from northern areas close to Lebanon, targeted by missiles from the Iran-backed group Hezbollah, a Hamas ally.
I'm looking out across the Sea of Galilee, and you can probably hear the rain around me that's splashing into the swimming pool here at the holiday resort I'm standing in, surrounded by holiday cottages. They've been inhabited for the past 4 months by the residents of the communities up by the Lebanese border. And now they say they want to go home.
Michael Piha, a resident of Kibbutz Sasa, says tolerance for life on the front line has shrunk.
Going back to something that we used to live that way is no longer an option. It's no longer an option that we are be under the threat of some guy in Beirut that would like to pull the trigger anytime he likes.
Israel says Hezbollah must retreat from the border before residents can return. But diplomacy hasn't so far delivered results.
Israel's war with Hamas has led some to say it should take on Hezbollah too. But Hezbollah is a different kind of enemy, and this would be a different kind of war.
In the border town of Hanita, a mortar fired by Hezbollah from Lebanon has smashed through the top floor of a house. The army tells me its residents were evacuated hours before. Lieutenant Colonel Dotan is a reservist with the army here.
This is a war. Our job is to make them come back. Hopefully, we'll provide enough security so they'll feel secure to move back. My own personal family has been evacuated. My kids tell me, we want to move back to our home.
Israel's government is under conflicting pressures over how to manage the conflicts on its borders and how to get both its hostages and its residents home. They're empty houses, domestic hostages in this conflict, for which Israel's government is paying a rising price.
Our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson with that report. The Kremlin has hit back at claims made by the widow of the Russian opposition politician Alexei Navalny that President Vladimir Putin was behind his death. Since Mr. Navalny died in prison last week, his family have been denied access to his body. Today, his mother released a video appealing for the return of her son's body. Our Eastern European correspondent Sarah Rainsford reports.
Alexei Navalny's mother recorded this appeal in the thick snow outside the Arctic prison where he died. For 5 days, she says, she's been unable even to find out where his body is. Now she's appealed to Vladimir Putin to intervene to get her son's body released immediately for burial. Earlier, an official told the family it would take another 2 weeks as further tests were carried out. Navalny's team suspect the delay is deliberate to prevent them learning the true cause of the politician's sudden death in prison. This video follows a statement by Navalny's widow, Yulia, in which she accused Vladimir Putin directly of killing him. Today, the Kremlin spokesman called those claims obnoxious and unsubstantiated. He added that he'd say no more, as Yulia Navalny had just been widowed.
Sarah Rainsford. Meanwhile, the Russian Security Service, the FSB, says it has arrested a Russian-American dual citizen suspected of treason and raising funds for Ukraine. The 33-year-old woman was detained in Russia's Urals region. She's understood to be a resident of Los Angeles and stands accused of proactively collecting funds that would buy aid and military supplies for Ukraine. Meanwhile, a Russian military pilot who defected to Ukraine last year has been killed in Spain. Anna Foster heard more from Vitaly Shevchenko from BBC Monitoring.
The Russian Security Service, the FSB, did not name her. And as we've seen in the video, her face is almost completely concealed by her hat. But Russian independent journalists operating from abroad, they say they have identified her as somebody who is originally from Ekaterinburg, the city where she was arrested. And reportedly, she later got married to an American national and moved to Los Angeles. Now, the exact circumstances of her alleged wrongdoing are not clear, but some reports in Russia say that she supposedly transferred less than $100 to a Ukrainian organization supporting the military, and she is not the first or the only American citizen held in Russian jails. The most prominent of them is, of course, Evan Gershkovich, the reporter for the Wall Street Journal, who has been languishing in a Russian jail for almost a year now, suspected of spying. And this morning, a Russian court rejected his appeal against pre-trial detention. And President Putin, when he was speaking in an interview earlier this month, he suggested that Evan Gershkovich might be exchanged for a Russian Security Service assassin who is currently being held in jail in Germany.
And let's move on as well to that story we also mentioned about this helicopter pilot who defected from Russia and has now been found dead.
Yes, Maxim Kuzminov was a Russian military pilot whose job was to transfer parts for Russian jets. But in August last year, he flew his helicopter across the border and into Ukraine under a scheme launched by the Ukrainian government called I Want to Live, which encourages Russian soldiers to defect. And he was reportedly paid $500,000 for what he did. And now reports say that he's been found dead in an underground garage in Spain. And interestingly, Russian state TV last October broadcast a report saying that Russian security services had been given the order to eliminate Mr. Kuzminov. And this morning, commenting on his killing, the head of Russian Foreign Intelligence Service, Sergei Naryshkin, said that Mr. Kuzminov had become a moral corpse. That's a quote when he defected to Ukraine.
Vitaly Shevchenko from BBC Monitoring. Russia's Wagner mercenary group has long been shrouded in the sort of mystery that's the stock in trade of spy novels. Semi-independent, conveniently deniable, there's been little doubt that in the final analysis it's controlled by Vladimir Putin. The fate of its one-time leader, Yevgeny Prigozhin, made that much clear. As soon as he got too big for his boots, briefly challenging the authorities in Moscow, his days were numbered. Now, a new report from one of Britain's leading defence think tanks has shed light on the rebranded post-Prigozhin Wagner. Joe Inwood has been studying its findings.
So they've basically found that post-Prigozhin, Wagner's been broken into two main sections. One called the Volunteer Corps. That's basically the bit of Wagner that was operating in Ukraine. And then this thing called the Expeditionary Corps, which is basically their operations in the rest of the world, primarily Africa. And it's being run by a man called Andrei Avryanov. Now, people might not know his name, but they'll know some of the things he's accused of doing. This is the man, a general, who ran a Russian unit accused of being behind the Salisbury poisonings in the UK. And so what they've done is they've gone to the various African nations and leaders where Wagner had an operation and said to them, right, you're now working with us. You're working with the Russian state. This is coming in-house. And they've been offering them something called a regime survival package.
And what does all this mean for the people of those countries where Wagner operates? And what is this regime survival package?
So regime survival package is basically the same sort of thing as was offered before, where they give you presidential guards, they give you informational warfare capabilities, and basically hard power on the ground, hard Russian power. Now, this means a number of things. Firstly, for the governments in question, it means they're more likely to survive, to maintain their position. And we're talking about governments here who've often taken power through a coup. But also what it means for the people on the ground. So, say, if you're a rebel group or you're some sort of dissident, you're going to be coming up against hard Russian firepower. And I was speaking to Dr. Jack Watling. He's from RUSI, and he wrote the report. And he said that the consequences of this can be pretty terrible for people in these countries.
They are using pretty traditional Soviet anti-partisan methods. And so this is very violent. It's not indiscriminate because the intent of targeting those civilians is terror. but it is the use of hard power to try and suppress opposition to the government in countries that are relatively fragile and ethnically diverse.
And the ripples of this strategy spread far beyond Africa, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. So this isn't just a question of them taking natural resources, which is the way that they operate. They will acquire the kind of the mineral rights and to various valuable commodities in Africa. But what they're also doing is trying to displace Western interests, because there are things, partly there are things like timber and gold, they're just valuable, but there are other things like lithium or uranium, which are strategically important. And I spoke to a man called Christopher Steele. He's a former British spy looking at Russia. And he said that the techniques they might use could also cynically manipulate the populations of these countries.
One of the really kind of resonant issues here in the last few years has been mass migration from Africa and from the Middle East into Europe, which has created this kind of populist right-wing backlash, people like Viktor Orban in Hungary and so on. And I think that this is where they're coming from. I think this is part of their thinking, the Russians, in terms of this type of warfare going forward. And I think their ability to turn off and on the tap of migration into Europe from places like West Africa will be significant going forward.
Joe Inwood. Still to come in this podcast.
It's the black hole's meal in the making that is being basically presented on a plate to the black hole that is emitting all of this light.
The most luminous object ever detected has been spied in the distant universe.
In 1969, a plan to show support for an anti-racism protest turned the lives of 14 promising black student athletes upside down.
I don't think we realized what the true flavor of Wyoming was back in 1969.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells the story of the Black 14.
There was a rebel Confederate flag being flown.
It was different. It was definitely different.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is making another bid to halt his extradition to the US in London today. The 52-year-old has spent the last 5 years in London's Belmarsh prison after he was accused of publishing leaked military documents. Our correspondent Nikki Schiller has been outside the High Court, where a very loud gathering of Julian Assange's supporters have been listening to speeches, including from his wife.
For the last 5 years, Julian Assange has been fighting extradition to the US to face trial over leaking military secrets. It actually all began back in 2010 when WikiLeaks disclosed huge numbers of military files about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. That included footage of a US helicopter gunning down civilians in Baghdad. Now, the US says that that put lives at risk, and they want him to face 18 charges under the Espionage Act. Julian Assange says it's all politically motivated and he has just exposed wrongdoing. Now, you'll remember for a while, Mr. Assange took refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy, but he was eventually arrested in 2019 and has since then been in Belmarsh prison. There's been a number of legal cases where his team argued that if he was extradited to the United States, he would be at risk because he might harm himself. Now, the US then gave assurances that that wouldn't happen. In 2021, the High Court ruled that the extradition could go ahead. And then in 2022, the Supreme Court upheld that ruling. And then the then Home Secretary in Britain, Priti Patel, signed that order allowing the extradition. And now where we are today is that his team are beginning a two-day High Court hearing, and they're going to argue that he should be allowed to appeal against that decision of the Home Secretary to extradite him. His wife has just arrived and spoken to the crowd, saying that it was a big day ahead and they didn't know what to expect, but she said the world is watching.
We have two big days ahead. We don't know what to expect, but you're here because the world is watching. They have to know they can't get away with this. Julian needs his freedom, and we all need the truth. Thank you.
And then lawyers of Assange have said that if they lose this, they'll take it to the European Court of Human Rights.
Well, yes, that is what they are saying. So basically, their lawyers say if he is extradited, he is convicted, he faces up to 175 years in prison. And the US government deny that and say that it would only be 4 to 6 years. Now, the hearing today and tomorrow, if it is rejected, then there is a possibility that his team can go to the European Court of Rights to what is known as look for a royal Rule 39 order. That is to temporarily stop the plane from taking off.
Nikki Schiller outside the High Court. Doctors in South Korea have gone on strike over plans to increase the number of medical students. The medics fear the government's proposals could eventually see their salaries squeezed. These residents of Seoul are worried about the impact of the strike.
If doctors go on strike, my daughter's surgery might be delayed and the treatment period might become even longer. So I'm very worried about it. I hope the situation will be resolved. I feel like they're using sick people as an excuse. I hope doctors and the government find some compromise and they quickly return to their posts so that patients don't miss their treatment.
I put it to our Asia-Pacific editor, Mickey Bristow, that the doctors weren't exactly endearing themselves to patients.
Well, you're right. It hasn't endeared them to their patients. The majority of people in South Korea are in favour of this government plan, which essentially would increase the number of trainee doctors each year from 3,000 to 5,000. And South Korea does have a shortage of medical staff, of doctors particularly. The average per 1,000 population is about 3.7 doctors. That's in developed countries. In South Korea, it's just 2.5. So there seems to be a need for this. But doctors have gone on strike. Thousands of them, mostly trainee doctors, have handed in their resignations. They're saying this won't solve the problem. The problems that the healthcare service faces in South Korea, notably a lot of doctors, shortage of doctors in rural areas. They say they haven't been consulted and they've got a number of other complaints. But on the face of it, it's difficult to see why so many more doctors is a bad thing in South Korea, indeed in anywhere.
And what's the immediate impact likely to be as far as patients are concerned?
Well, the use of the word there, immediate, there's already been an impact immediately. Surgeries, operations have been cancelled. At the moment, I think there's about just under 2,000 doctors who have walked out. Many more are threatening to join them. The government is saying it has a legal right to force some doctors back to work because they're in a reserved profession that they can't strike so as easily as other professions and other working people. But at the moment, it's already starting to affect. And of course, the fear is as this strike continues in the days and perhaps weeks to come, that the effect on the medical services in South Korea will be even greater.
Mickey Bristow. Scientists believe they've identified the brightest ever object detected in the known universe, and it's being caused by an enormous black hole. The team say it's probably been visible in the night sky for longer than humans have existed, but has only just been identified as a quasar, the burning centre of an active galaxy powered by a supermassive black hole. This one is said to be as bright as 500 trillion suns, but is so far away from the Earth that its light has taken 12 billion years to reach us. Christian Wolf is an associate professor of astrophysics at the Australian National University and part of the team who made the discovery.
Black hole means it's supposed to be black. It's when you concentrate a mass so much that near its surface, the force of gravity would be so strong that not even light can escape. That makes it black. And that's still true here. But what is different is that this black hole is not just a sleeping giant in the darkness of the universe, but it actually eats matter as we watch it, and loads of matter. In fact, around about one sun worth of material every single day. So when this matter gets close to the black hole, it's gets dragged into a giant disk. And that's like a holding pattern for all the material that the black hole will eventually devour. And in this disk, all the material rubs up against all the other material. There are magnetic fields running. They are breaking down. There is lots of lightning flashes. There's a lot of heat generated, and it's the radiation from this accretion disk that we see. So it's not literally the black hole. It's the black hole's meal in the making that is being basically presented on a plate to the black hole that is emitting all of this light.
Christian Wolf from the Australian National University. And that's all from us for now. But there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. I just have time to tell you about a request from our Happy Pod colleagues. Do you live in the Republic of Kiribati, perhaps in the town of Banana? We're keen to speak to you if you are about place names and life there. Please email us at globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk so we can have a chat. You can also comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it. You can also send us an email. You can find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by James Piper. The producer was Stephanie Tillotson. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Rachel Wright. Until next time, goodbye. Thank you.